Show. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Welcome to Titanic Tuesday on the Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. That is where you'll find entrance to the chat room. Folks wandering into the chat room even now as I speak. Moderators Sparky and Texas Betsy are there and standing by. Also, you'll find at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com a selection of the day's news for your consideration. Wander on by. There's also, of course, the PayPal button. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is something that runs exclusively by virtue of your continued support. We try to raise $150 an evening, which is really not a heck of a lot in when you consider other undertakings. Not much at all. $150 an evening, 15 folks at $10 a piece, 10 folks at $15 a piece, 2 people at $75, 3 at $50, 6 at $25. You see how it works. And we also have a postal address in case you prefer to work it that way. Just remember, all checks, money orders need to be paid to Head On Communications and not Bob Kincaid. Is Bob Kincaid does not, well, see the money. It supports this effort. And also, you know the address, I presume. The Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318, Beckley, BECKLEYWV 25801. It's just that easy. So, thank you for your support. That's how we've been able to keep going for these many years. I almost said that 10 times. Yeah, 10 years we've been at this. And it is extremely, extremely humbling to know that folks tune in just, for this conversation, because this is special. This is unlike anything going on anywhere else. Among other things, we got Dr. Bill. And if you listen to today's program, as I did, in rapt attention, Dr. Bill touched on a number of topics, not the least of which was his description of watching a friend's effects be cleared out of her home and her papers shoveled into trash bags and carried away to be destroyed. And how that leads to the ongoing question of what does it mean to have had the biblical 70 upon this little blue-green time machine hurtling through the universe. Special indeed. If you did not catch the program live, you can find the podcast over at whiterosesociety.org under the subdomain for Dr. Bill, of course. Live programs are always available at TuneIn Radio and Stitcher Radio. Stitcher also puts up the previous archive of the program, making it easy to get at via your mobile device, your tablet device, what have you. So this is Titanic. Oh, hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. Yes. This is Titanic Tuesday on the Horn. We celebrate on Titanic Tuesday the titanic intellect of the right wing in this country, the name having been inspired by a remark made by a 972nd tier right-wing yammerhead over in America's fifth smallest radio market, Beckley, West Virginia, who once explained to one of his mouth-breathing, knuckle-walking listeners that in point of fact, there are fossilized shellfish in the rock strata of the Appalachian Mountains of West Virginia because of the movement of the Titanic plates. God only knows what was deposited by the movement of the Titanic punch bowl. See how it works? Yeah. So that's why. The source of Titanic Tuesday is a celebration, if that is the appropriate phrase, of the arrant stupidity that is the soup and nuts, emphasis on nuts, of the wholly toxic Otne Ute Aitbre right wing in this once great nation. And dear Lord God, we got some material to work with this evening. No getting around it. I spent the better part of most of the nation's attention was focused today on the Conestoga wagon Hobby Lobby arguments in front of the Supreme Court of the United States. And justifiably so. Because that case is extremely dangerous to real freedom in this country, insofar as it represents another milestone opportunity for that dead-eyed John Roberts to advance the corporate agenda and declare that not only a la Citizens United are corporations persons in the United States under the Constitution, but they are also religious persons. Which is about as dumb in the head as a hog is in the ass, but we are, after all, talking about the Roberts Court. We're talking about the rats, Roberts, Alito, Thomas, and Scalia. And, of course, Anthony Kennedy, whose vote can be swayed by nothing more than a harsh look from Fat Tony Scalia. If you wish to talk about that, we certainly may. Other things to talk about? Well, what I spent my day at... Really? At? What I spent my day doing was watching the debate, the floor debate, on a nasty little piece of garbage that had been vomited out of the Republican Natural Resources Committee in the House of Representatives. Called, oh dear God, this is just, it doesn't get much more Orwellian than this, the Preventing Government Waste and Protecting Coal Mining Jobs in America Act, H.R. 2824. And as far as watching the Republicans were concerned, it was the usual procession of bought and paid for coal whores. You know, the original sponsor of the bill was Bill Johnson of Ohio. What in God's name is wrong with the people in Ohio's 6th Congressional District? I don't know. But they sent that jackanapes to the Congress so he could protect coal jobs. And by extension, poison perfectly innocent babies in the womb, families living under mountaintop, because it was basically a mountaintop removal bill. It has to do with something, and this can get pretty esoteric pretty quick, something called the stream buffer zone rule. Back in 1983, the stream buffer zone rule was promulgated under St. Ronnie of Raygun, and it said that you could not dump waste from a strip mining operation within 100 miles, within 100 feet of a stream. waste. And you certainly couldn't dump it into the stream. Well, we got along not well with that. I mean, they were still blasting the bejesus out of Appalachia and poisoning people and whatnot. But the coal industry didn't feel like it was poisoning enough people. There were more people out there to be poisoned, you know, because money. And so consequently, after the disastrous stolen election of November 2000, Dim Leader came into office.
Let me know, I'm the decider.
And his administration clarified the stream buffer zone rule, and the way they clarified it was to note that all the poisons, all the heavy metals, all the toxins, all the nasty stuff that comes out of a mountaintop removal operation, well, they're not waste. They're fill. Yeah. And so once it became fill, well, golly jeepers, they could just dump whatever they wanted to into the streams. They could bury the streams. And in fact, they did so with real dedication. They buried more than 2,000 miles of Appalachian streams. Some of this may not be new to you. Some of you may already be as well-versed as any hillbilly advocate against mountaintop removal. And if you're that well-versed because you've been listening to this program. But the fact of the matter is, those little streams, those rills, those creeks, those brooks that run down from the mountains, down in the hollers, and eventually meet other larger creeks, and eventually find their way into rivers, go downstream and affect a whole bunch of the United States of America. Okay, so far. So what happened is the Obama administration took, and understand, the Dim Leader administration did this whole clarification business in the dark and still of the night, kind of with nobody watching. And so the Obama administration took a look at it and said, we don't really think that's cricket, and began looking at a rewrite of the buffer zone rule to get it back to, I mean, we're talking about Barack Obama here, to get it back to its Reagan-esque roots. Remember back when Barack Obama was spending his summer beach vacation reading up on Ronald Reagan? Yeah, me too. So a couple of weeks back, a federal court actually heard a case regarding the stream buffer zone rule and declared that the Bush stream buffer zone rule was in fact a bit of illegal nasty business. Funny how the Bush administration was so good at illegal nasty business. Just ask Iraq. Wander around Fallujah a little bit sometime, why don't you? Lots of nasty business. And some of the people who did the nasty business are still out there walking free as a bird and saying really, really stupid, nasty business things. More on that later. Hi, Don Rumfield. Oh, we got a lot to talk about today. Somewhere along the way, I may get around to discussing why it is that I may have to take a vow never to play another Rolling Stones song so long as I live. And that's tough. That's really tough. But it also matters. But anyway, back to the stream buffer zone rule. So because the Republican Party lives to serve the hydrocarbon industry, and particularly lives to serve the coal industry in this instance, they crafted H.R. 2824, the Preventing Government Waste and Protecting Coal Mining Jobs in America, proudly sponsored by Representing Bill Johnson of Ohio's 6th District. Where the hell is the Ohio 6th District? Who's responsible for this? Let's find out. as the owl said in the old Tootsie Pop commercial. Ah, there it is. Okay. Okay. Yeah, we know it's representing Bill Johnson. The district runs along the southeast side of the state, bordering Kentucky, West Virginia, and Pennsylvania. It stretches from rural Lucasville through Athens and several older Ohio River industrial towns all the way to the Youngstown city limits. It's a narrow strip of, you know, Gallipolis. Yeah. All right, I understand things a little bit better. Well, anyway, so Bill Johnson wants to do him some cold job protecting. Let's see, here's the full title. To amend the Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act of 1977 to stop the ongoing waste by the Department of the Interior of taxpayer resources and implement the final rule on excess spoil, mining waste, and buffers for perennial and intermittent streams and for other purposes. Okay, well, point well taken, Jeremy. Bob, when it comes to the topic of MTR, we really do need a duct tape and tennis ball issue warning. You see, even though I know most of this horror called MTR. I get it. I keep one handy myself. So let's... Oh, wait. Went to the wrong one. Hang on here. Let's take a quick peek at the bill text. See how long it takes to get down into the bill to find out that Obama is a Kenyan Muslim fascist, yada, yada, yada. Oh, okay. Wouldn't want that to happen, Jeremy. He says, I was drinking cold tea and it almost boiled in my throat. What'd you make it with mountaintop removal water? The secretary may not issue any regulations under this act relating to stream buffer zones or stream protection before the date of the publication of the report under paragraph 2, other than a rule necessary to implement paragraph 1. So, in other words, we're not going to have anybody jumping out there trying to keep from burying more thousands of miles of streams. Great guys, these. I mean, really. And actually tucked away in all of this is a little bit of history. Oh, it was slippery history, but tucked away is a little bit of history. More than simply getting out there and grandstanding and jumping up and down and hooting like a barn owl and hollering war on coal, which they did a bunch of. They brought a couple of really big stupid guns to the debate, the right wing did. They brought, and really this would have been so much better for yesterday, being more in Monday and all, they brought out Steve Scalise from Louisiana Stan, who, one gets the idea, could not pour piss out of a boot with directions on the heel. Because Steve Scalise, in his remarks, in support of poisoning more Appalachian people, because that's what this boils down to. They want more mountaintop removal, not less of it. They want more Appalachian people poisoned, more birth defects, more heart disease, more cancer, more mental illness, more, among babies, old folks, aunts, uncles, cousins, brothers, sisters, mommies, daddies, sons, daughters, neighbors, pals, what have you. They want more of it because more poisoning is good for America. And if tomorrow all my dynamite was taken away from me and my wife, I'd still love the USA. Yeah, something like that. I never could remember the lyrics to that dumbass song. So Steve Scalise gets up and he says, And we're here to, instead of supporting job creation, we're standing here in Washington, D.C. in March, and it's snowing, which proves climate change ain't real. Really, dumbass? Really? Snow? in March in Washington, D.C. proves there's no such thing as climate change. Well, shut my mouth. Because, see, I was laboring under the apparent misapprehension, according to Steve Scalise, that the fringes of the seasonal changes had effects whereby they could distinctly resemble the season that had just changed over. For instance, quite often at the beginning of summer, you'll have spring-like rains, at least around here. Or quite often at the beginning of winter, it will act almost fall-like, and you'll wonder, some winter. Hell's bells, I remember 2 years ago, last December 31st, when it was 72 degrees and clear and sunny outside. Very much not like it. But anyway, now, snowing in D.C. in March, according to Steve Scalise from Louisiana Stan, who apparently must live next to a refinery or something, he's been huffing fumes, means that climate change is not real. But then the real Lulu arrived in the form of a big, boisterous jackass by the name of Mike Kelly of Pennsylvania. You know that old, and I learned this from Rick Smith, that old line about how Pennsylvania is Philadelphia in the east and Pittsburgh in the west and Alabama in the middle. I think Mike Kelly comes from the Alabama part. Because he got himself right wrought about how delightful and delicious and glorious and patriotic coal is. And then, toward the end of his oration, declared that because of the Obama administration, no, this is the duct tape and tennis ball part. Just, you know, wedge it in there, just go across the face. It doesn't have to go around your hair. That's such a bitch when you try to. Just get that, you can tell, just try to holler, and if you can't get that, then you're okay. So, in the midst of this fervid maundering that Mike Kelly was doing, he declared, and I am not kidding, I was watching this. It was a miracle, but I'd managed to stay out of the tequila while watching it. Sometimes you just feel like you're lashed to the mast like Odysseus having to listen to the sirens when you're going through the... Yeah. But I did hear it with my own ears. Wish I could find the audio of it. Mike Kelly declared that now, there were no qualifiers, that the lights are going out all over America. No, he really did. History fans are just now tugging at the straps there, having already duct taped and tennis balls. I know. Yeah, failure to pass this bill and poison more hillbillies and bury more streams and blast more mountaintops and put more ultrafine particulate matter into the air meant the lights are going out all over America. Write that down. The lights are going out all over America, because this has some relevance. I imagine, for whatever handful of people who heard that phrase, well, damn, he's just crazy. No, well, I mean, he's crazy, but if he's crazy, he's teabagger crazy. Because the lights are going out has context. It has meaning. It comes from somewhere else. It wasn't just an idea that Mike Kelly of Republican from Pennsylvania had as some nightmare dystopian vision that somehow or another, if we weren't poisoning more hillbillies, that the lights would go. Because even Mike Kelly, for the love of Christ, knows that less than 4% of electrical generation comes from mountaintop removal. Well, let me qualify that. Electrical generation in the United States is 37% from coal. Of that 37%, less than 4% comes from mountaintop removal. So in point of fact, you could end mountaintop removal tomorrow and the lights wouldn't go out any goddamn where. Now, what is this? What, is Mike Kelly from Pennsylvania just dumber than a goddamn rock? Is he just stupid as shoe leather? Well, maybe. Or is there something else at work? Hint, the answer is B, something else at work. Got a little something for you here. A little piece of audio. Just, you know, listen up.
Alexander the Great remarked that the peoples of Asia were slaves because they had not learned to pronounce the word no. Let that not be the epitaph of the English-speaking people, or of parliamentary democracy, or of France, or of the many surviving liberal states of Europe.
Liberal.
There, in one single word, is the resolve which the forces of freedom and progress, of tolerance and goodwill, there is the resolve which they should take. It is not in the power of one nation, however formidably armed. Still less is it in the power of a small group of men, violent, ruthless men, who have always, however, to cast their eyes back over their shoulders. It is not in their power to cramp and fetter the forward march of human destiny. The preponderant world forces are upon our side. They have but to be combined to be obeyed. We must arm. Britain must arm. America must arm. We shall no doubt arm. Britain, casting away the habits of centuries, will decree national service for her citizens. But arms, instrumentalities, as President Wilson called them, are not sufficient by themselves. We must add to them the power of ideas. People say, many people, we ought not to allow ourselves to be drawn into a theoretical antagonism between Nazism and democracy.
I was just waiting for him to mention the Nazis. Or maybe, or perhaps we would have had to go on for a while before we got around to Herr Hitler. Okay, Bob, what the hell was that? Well, that was a speech given by broadcast via the BBC to the United States and to the UK by Winston Churchill on the 16th day of October 1938, in which he stentorianly hoped to encourage the United States to get into the coming Second World War that he was quite certain, correctly, was on the way. It was, in point of fact, the shooting part of it, less than a year away from the European standpoint. Now, those Asian people who he slurred in the first part of that clip, they'd already had a little taste of warfare. You know, a soupçon. But Churchill never missed an opportunity to sleaze on non-white peoples, because, well, he was Churchill. this speech, by the way, I know he was a scholar and everything, but saying that Alexander the Great said anything, Jesus, I don't think any history we have of Alexander the Great is any nearer in time than 100 years or so, maybe 200, maybe 300 years after the death of Alexander. That's what makes Alexander such a slippery fish to try to get a hold of historically. That's how you can get away with casting, what's his face, in the movie. Who was that? Oh, anyway. So why did I play the Defense of Freedom and Peace speech, or a chunk of it, from the 16th day of October 1938? Well, because. Because when I was sitting there earlier today, resisting the urge to tear at my hair and rend my garments and run screaming out into the yard at all the right-wing idiocy that was being played out before my eyes and unto my ears, I heard Mike Kelly, Repiglickin' from Pennsylvania, say, "The lights are going out all over America." And I stopped and said, "Wait a minute. This is one of those moments where I just have the kind of mind where things get stuck back in there. And every now and then, you know, whoop, it's like a little kick in the head. You know, a little smack, you know, a little go wash your rice bowls kind of thing. And you go, lights are going out all over America. What the? That's crazy. And then I stopped him. Oh, but Mike Kelly's a teabagger. What do teabaggers think? Teabaggers think that President Obama is Hitler. Son of a... How's... Oh... No, really. The lights are going out all over America is a direct reference to this. I avail myself with relief of the opportunity of speaking to the people of the United States. I do not know how long such liberties will be allowed. The stations of uncensored expression are closing down. The lights are going out, but there is still time for those to whom freedom and parliamentary government mean something to consult together. Let me then speak in truth and earnestness while time remains. Yeah. What Churchill meant by the lights are going out is that the Nazis and Herr Hitler were on the march. And they were gobbling up things like the Sudetenland and Czechoslovakia. And Poland was looking pretty tasty long about then. And, well, I don't think the Belgians and the French were feeling any too comfy either. So, slyly, and I do not credit Mike Kelly with having this much in the way of brains, but somebody on his staff wrote those remarks for him. And by extension, he actually compared the diminishing use of coal in generating electricity in the United States to the Nazi march across Europe. Those wind turbines? Nazis. Solar panels? Nazis. Obama? Hitler. And I'm sure that he wandered back into his office, rubbing his fat little fingers together. I called that Obama Hitler just like he is. And they ain't never even going to recognize it. And thus far, I don't know if anyone besides me has. Interestingly, however, because history is like an onion, it has layers. Otto von Bismarck once said, the mistakes that have been committed in foreign policy are not, as a rule, apparent to the public until a generation afterwards. So therein lies the trick. Recognizing the mistakes in public policy before the next generation. And I substitute public policy for foreign policy because I think it's equally applicable. For instance, way back when Jimmy Carter begrudgingly signed the Surface Mine Control and Reclamation Act, which Doc Hastings, for pig licking from Washington, admitted today can never, ever, ever, ever act to protect the health and well-being of the people who have to live with mountaintop removal. Back when Jimmy Carter was begrudgingly signing it into law, he said, "This is a terrible law." How right he was. Because the Surface Mine Control and Reclamation Act, brought to you by Representative Nick Joe Rahal, who incidentally was given Democrat, because he's a Democrat, was given him time, he was given time today by the Democrats who were opposing this dumbass bill. He stood up there to take time away from Democrats like Rush Holt, like John Yarmuth, like Raul Grijalva, like Pete DeFazio, who were delivering stirring arguments, fact-based arguments, real arguments against H.R. 2824. He stood up and took away 3 minutes of limited House time to stand up and say, "Golly, I sure do like this Republican bill, because coal, because money." And I thought to myself, I need to know a little bit more about House of Representatives procedure. Why didn't he take away the time of the Republicans that he was voting with, who he was supporting, instead of taking up the valuable time of the Democrats who had the courage to stand up against the further poisoning of Rahal's constituents, whom he cannot be bothered to stand up for? Nick Rahal represents the single most ill, the single sickest district, congressional district in the United States of America, the West Virginia 3rd Congressional District. He represents that district. And yet he stood up to oppose his fellow Democrats who were opposing the idea of making his, Rahal's, constituents sicker still. Sort that one out and get back with me. No, but anyway. A generation ago, Nick Rahal helped give us the Surface Mine Control and Reclamation Act, which doesn't give a tinker's damn about anybody who has to live around or near or by or what mountaintop removal. The Surface Mine Control and Reclamation Act even references mountaintop removal as being something that coal companies can do. It had only been invented 5 years before, or first tried out 5 years before. Oddly enough, Kurt Vonnegut wrote about it in Breakfast of Champions. No, maybe it was God Bless You, Mr. Rosewater. Can't remember. In which he noted that in 100 years' time, the people of West Virginia had managed to destroy and burn up where they live for heat. So Bismarck's point is well taken. The mistakes that have been committed in policy are not, as a rule, apparent to the public until a generation afterwards. Smart guy, that Bismarck. Meanwhile, the parade of idiots proceeded over on the Repiglican side with people like Doc Hastings and Bill Johnson declaring that we have to blow up more mountains and poison more hillbillies because Putin. You think I'm kidding? I could not be more in earnest. He did. We have to protect America's domestic supply of coal to send a message to the Ruskies. They, you know what? These Republicans never fail to delight. Because, of course, we have mountain complexes here in West Virginia that are daily blasted to smithereens to get at little shitty six-inch seams of coal that get in trucks, then get on trains, and then go and get on barges or go all the way to the coast and get on a boat. And guess where they go? Russia! Because a patriotic, good American by the name of Jim Justice, who is not fit to lay flowers on Judy Bond's or Larry Gibson's graves, billionaire though he may be, Jim Justice sold out his mining properties, his mountaintop removal mines and his underground mines. He sold them out to Russia. That's some patriot, huh? Yeah, what the hell? You know, I still think we need to remove In God We Trust from the money and change it to The Business of America is Business. Or maybe just change it to Larry of Larry Darrell and Darrell's Anything for a Buck. What kind of sorry, sleazy, filthy, anti-American, un-American, scum of the earth sells out the people of his own state, their lives, their well-being, their health, sells it out to Russia? And yet at the same time, we have to let the Russians keep blowing up the mountains and sending the coal to Russia to prove a point to Putin? You know, every now and then I'm confronted by the eternal question, is the tequila bottle half empty or is the tequila bottle half full? Days like this, it looks half empty. Because there ain't no way there's enough. Jim is a step ahead of me. Because it wasn't just, in point of fact, Winston Churchill very seldom said anything originally. He was full of quips and one-liners, and he practiced them hour after hour. And he studied the words of other people. You know, note the little slur he attributed to, the little anti-Asian slur that he attributed to Alexander the Great. Well, in point of fact, that lights are going out line from the 16th October 1938 Defense of Freedom speech, Churchill was paraphrasing. Churchill was paraphrasing the Foreign Secretary of the UK of 1914. The man's name was Edward Grey. Well, I guess we have to call him Sir Edward Grey. Then again, being an American, I don't have to recognize that kind of crap. He was Edward Grey. What the king or the queen thinks of him, well, you know, that and $6 will get you a cup of coffee at Starbucks. It was along about the third day of August, 1914, to use the current argo, shit was getting real real fast on August the 3rd, 1914. British Foreign Secretary Sir Edward Grey. I said it. Damn it. See how British Foreign Secretary Edward Grey was leaving his office. As he prepared to leave, he was standing at the window of his room in the Foreign Office when the editor of the Westminster Gazette approached him and was standing by him. Edward Grey looked down onto the streets of London, where he saw the lamps being lighted. And he turned to John Alfred Spender, and he said, "The lamps are going out all over Europe. We shall not see them lit again in our lifetime." And that has a poignancy to it, too. Because once again, here we are, 100 years after one of the single greatest acts of stupidity of white folks, namely the First World War. In which the business class convinced the ruling class to go to war with itself and to slaughter some several millions of working class people to figure out who was the better monarch. And make a little money in the process. So you pick, was Mike Kelly of the Alabama part of Pennsylvania referring to Winston Churchill and calling, and remember he's a teabagger, and by extension calling Barack Obama Hitler? Or was he, and this seems extremely much less likely to me, referencing somehow that the decline of coal-fired electricity in the United States represented, oh, wait, a German onslaught across with. Hey, I guess it can be both. Barack Obama is either Hitler or Kaiser Wilhelm II. But that's just the stupid part of the debate. There was also an inspiring part of the debate. The inspiring part of the debate came from the Democrats. And not just any Democrats. The opposition to this shamefully prostitutional bill was led by a member of the House of Representatives from New Jersey by the name of Rush Holt. Rush Holt, of course, is the son of a former senator for the state of West Virginia. Some portion of his heart is still back here in the hills. A not insignificant portion of him, perhaps all of him, grieves. Because he is, after all, also a scientist. One of those sciencey people who thinks sciencey things and makes his decisions based on sciencey stuff. He grieves at the destruction of his ancestral homeland. which West Virginia is. And so he led the charge. He led the opposition to this effort to bury more streams, blow up more mountains, poison more water, poison more people, cause more birth defects, seed more cancers, destroy more hearts. He led it. And he did so brilliantly. And along the way, he had help. He had help from Representative Peter DeFazio of Oregon, who, in no uncertain terms, called out the hypocrisy of these pro-coal jackasses who would rather see human beings, who would rather see mommies and daddies and little bitty babies in the womb poisoned than see an end to a form of coal extraction that means almost nothing to the economy of the United States. Peter DeFazio spoke strongly. Also speaking, Representative John Yarmuth of Kentucky, who talked about what a travesty mountaintop removal is. He talked about the health and well-being of people who live in Appalachia, as did Rush Holt, as did Peter DeFazio. Representative Jim Moran of Virginia stood boldly up and said, "We have no business blowing away people's homes for the sake of coal companies." Then came Representative Raul Grijalva of Arizona, and he spoke in opposition to this nightmare bill that seeks to poison more of my friends, my neighbors, my family, my loved ones, people I've never even met, but am fellow Appalachians with. And Representative Raul Grijalva asked a question that cut right to the heart of the entire issue. Are we the government? Are we the kind of government that poisons its own people? And although the camera did not cut away, I can just imagine that Doc Hastings and Doug Lamborn and representing Bill Johnson from Ohio's 6th District, dumbasses, sitting there nodding their heads going, "Yep, we sure are! Because money!" We found out We found out who actually gives a damn about the American people. Not the Republicans and all their talk of jobs. But we found out for damn sure that Representative Alan Lowenstein of California cares, because he offered an amendment to the bill that talked about the health and well-being of the people who, by no fault of their own, have to live with the poisons and the death and the grief and the agony and the suffering that is brought on day after day after day after day by mountaintop removal. The Republicans took his amendment out behind the barn and beat it to death with an old axe handle. We found out that Representative Matt Cartwright of Pennsylvania, by God, cares what happens to people who are trying to live their lives in Appalachia, because he, too, offered up an amendment. That amendment would have allowed local communities to pass more stringent standards than the hog-tied Department of Interior at whom this bill was aimed. And since they hadn't quite broke the axe handle over Representative Lowenthal's bill, they used it on Representative Cartwright's bill, too. And then they had their little vote. And the teabagging, godforsaken, birther, deather, tenther, booger-eater, bircher, igum-foo, repiglickens voted in favor of poisoning more hillbillies. And along come Nick Rahal on his stubby little legs going, "Me too! I want to poison my own constituents some more! Me too!" God, that just bugs the hell out of me. How could you... Well, never mind. Don't ask stupid questions, Bob. And, of course, the bill passed. It won't get past the Senate, no matter how much Joe Manchin hops up and down and says, see how nice my hair is? Look, I'm a centrist. I vote against brown people getting into this administration. Look, I'm a centrist. I vote against students being able to pay off their student loans. Look, I'm a centrist. It's still not going to pass the Senate. And even if it did pass the Senate, this might actually be the bill that Barack Obama took out in his first veto. But let me tell you a little something. And I think it'll make you proud. It'll make you as proud as it made me. Let me tell you a little something about the Democrats that stood up and opposed this godforsaken nightmare that the Republicans would wreak upon the children of Appalachia. Every single member of the House of Representatives who rose today in opposition to this god-awful bill is signatory to the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Act, H.R. 526. From the original sponsor, Representative Yarmuth of Kentucky. You out there, Corey? Be proud. Be mighty proud. To Rush Holt, who, for the first time ever, mentioned on the floor of the House of Representatives the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Act itself and said, "This is what we ought to be talking about, not that." To Representative Grijalva, to Representative DeFazio, to Representative Moran, to Representative Lowenthal, to Representative Cartwright, each and every one of them are signatory to the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Act, H.R. 526, and you, every one of you who have ever gone to your computer or picked up a phone and reached out to a member of Congress, you are part of that proud moment in which an admitted minority, but a group of members of the House, stood tall for one of the most voiceless parts of the United States. You had a hand in that. If you get a little bit of if maybe the little hairs stand up on the back of your neck, or you feel a little swell of pride, you darned well got a right to it. Because we saw today something that has never, ever happened before. We saw a generation's worth of talk about birds and bugs and beetles and butterflies that has cost us untold damage. We saw that replaced by real-world discussion of real-world health crises that are going on in American communities even as we speak. We saw today despite the claims of Mike Kelly that the lights are going out all over America, we actually saw the lights come on in America. Yes, we did. So maybe mark this day, the 25th day of March, 2014. And you had a hand in it, and you were part of it, and you can say, I was there. The debate changed. The tide turned. And it was because I chose to be active instead of passive. I chose to care about all of America, not just the part that happens to exist around me. That's what happened today. And I think even the Repiglicans know it. They were running scared with their war on coal. They kept, because nobody's buying it anymore. At one point in time, I forget which person it was, but they got it jammed right back in their face when one of the AIC Act co-sponsors said, if there's such a war on coal, why are there 5,000 more coal mining jobs now than when Barack Obama took office? Some war. Yeah. So that's what caught my interest today, but there are other interesting things out there. I hope you will take a hand in bringing some of them to the discussion. The lines are open. 304-658-3333 is the number. That's how you reach the program. Yes, the miracle is holding. The phone lines are still working. If you prefer to operate via Skype, Bob Kincaid Horn, BobKincaidHorn, is how you reach the program. BobKincaid@gmail.com is the email address. Hey, a little note here. You know, I was tweeting out a bunch of stuff today. And the beauty of Twitter is that there's a multiplier effect. If you want to help get these messages out, then follow me on Twitter at Bob Kincaid and retweet these things. Twitter's really easy. I mean, if Facebook is a pain in the ass for you, you're going to like Twitter a lot more because it's only 140 characters and they don't change the interface every 15 seconds like Facebook does. So give it a try, and you know what? When you get on Twitter and you follow me and I follow you back, and you retweet the stuff that we're talking about here, you're actually growing the horn at the same time. So I hope you'll give it consideration, and thanks to those who already do. And by the way, we do try to raise $150 every evening. We are, an hour and 6 minutes of filibobster, we are still at zero. We really do need your continued support in order to continue bringing the program out. There are still massive bills to pay. We have been eaten alive this winter by the coal-fired electricity at Appalachian Power. It's not a joke. So if you're inclined and you're able, hit the PayPal button. Or drop me a note and say, hey, it's in the mail. Tell Boss Man Wayne, and I'll tell Boss Man Wayne. Irish Dave asking, because he's clever with words this way, does this mean the coal party functionaries would be labeled Appalachics? Actually, no. Because nobody who gives a damn about Appalachia wants to blow it up. The people who are blowing up Appalachia are people in Pennsylvania and Virginia and New York and, well, Russia and India and the people who buy it and have it shipped over to, say, Holland and Germany and China. I have a hard time seeing them as Appalachians. Jeremy noting, when it comes to mountaintop removal, together we stand and divided we fall. I choose to stand and have called Bernie Sanders countless times about the AIC Act. Keep calling him, Jeremy. Keep calling him. So we'll take a little break. The Green News Report with Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen is on the way. You know that I look forward to these very much every Tuesday and Thursday. Today is no different. You do a great job, Brad and Desi do. So sit back, relax if you can. Hit the PayPal button and as much or more. Light up the dad-burned phone lines. 304-658-3333. We call what we do here Conversation Radio. The Head-On Radio Network, The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Yours, is it mine? I was never the kind to draw the line. It's Tuesday, March 25, 2014.
It's going to hurt a lot. I mean, these people are going to suffer.
Meet the nation's newest oil spill, now in Galveston Bay. Air pollution from fossil fuels now killing 7 million people a year. Plus...
you can't fix it. Once you break that egg sometime, that's it.
The legacy of the Exxon Valdez oil spill 25 years later.
All of those legacies and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
It's 25 years since the Exxon Valdez spill. And you know what technologies they're using now to clean up an oil spill, whether it's the one in Galveston Bay right now or 4 years ago with BP in the Gulf of Mexico? The same technologies they used 25 years ago.
Hey, if it ain't broke, it ain't the morally depraved fossil fuel industry. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, horrible, horrific story out of Snohomish County up in Washington State where 14 are confirmed dead as we go to air. Dozens and dozens more still missing in this terrible mudslide. Among the troubling issues up there, the scientists who in a 1999 report warned that there is the potential for a large catastrophic failure up there. This was geomorphologist Daniel Miller and his wife Lynn Rogers Miller. They said, we've known it would happen at some point. And yet county officials say that a slide of this magnitude was very difficult to predict. Quote, there was no indication at all. Well, there was indication. It seems like those indications and those warnings were just ignored.
Yes, I saw other scientists saying they were shocked that they allowed residential development again in the area after previous landslides. And, you know, unfortunately, climate change is likely to bring even more of those landslides. Computer models show the Pacific Northwest is likely to get even more heavier rains.
This is a song we've heard before, and the fact that it keeps being ignored, scientists keep being ignored, frankly, is just heartbreaking and deadly. What else do you have for us today that'll cheer us up now?
Well, nothing that will cheer us up, unfortunately.
Okay,
Monday marked the 25th anniversary of the beginning of the Exxon Valdez oil spill in Alaska, which has never really ended for the people who live there. March 24th, 1989, the Exxon Valdez supertanker ran aground in Alaska's once pristine Prince William Sound, spilling 11 million gallons of oil that eventually stretched for 11,000 square miles, killing countless animals and birds, decimating the region's fishing industry, as former fisherman Tom Anderson tells NPR.
It didn't take us long. You could smell it before you ever saw it. There was no fish, no birds chasing fish. You could sit there and it would just be dead quiet. So everybody called it the dead zone.
Exxon then used the court system to cut a $5 billion judgment for damages down to just a tenth of that, a mere $500 million, thanks to the U.S. Supreme Court. Of course, the Exxon Valdez spill never really ended for the Sound's people and its animals. Exxon's oil remains just below the surface of beaches, and the herring fishery collapsed completely, never to return.
How did the oil industry celebrate the 25th anniversary of the Exxon Valdez spill?
Well, funny you should ask. Almost 25 years to the day of the Exxon Valdez oil spill comes the nation's newest oil spill, now on the Texas Gulf Coast, where an oil barge collision spilled nearly 170,000 gallons of heavy crude oil into the Houston shipping channel, and the cause of the accident remains under investigation.
The Coast Guard and the National Transportation Safety Board, among others, are conducting an accident investigation to determine how this happened and how we can what we can learn from it to prevent this sort of thing in the future.
Nothing. We will learn nothing from it. We never learn anything from it. We do the same thing time and time and time again, year after year after year, decade after decade. When does it stop, Desi Doyen?
I have no idea. I do know that it's already having an economic impact. The spill has temporarily shut down one of the nation's busiest shipping channels, the Houston Shipping Channel. It's closed Galveston beaches and ferries during the all-important spring break season and is now threatening several important bird and wildlife refuges and fishing grounds.
And it's going to hurt a lot. I mean, these people are going to suffer. Until they get this fixed, and then after it's fixed, what's it going to be like?
But wait, there's more. Several major refineries have also been forced to cut back production until that channel reopens, and that will likely raise retail gas prices across the country. But of course, for the folks at Fox News, the nation's newest oil spill in Galveston is really just a distraction.
Yesterday's spill closing the shipping channel to the Gulf of Mexico. Anytime we hear these kind of things, it feels like another impediment to growing out our fossil fuel industry.
Yes, yes, major disasters are an impediment to your fossil fuel industry.
Meanwhile, fossil fuels just keep on giving. The World Health Organization announced this week that air pollution from burning fossil fuels kills an estimated 7 million people every year. That's one in every 8 people on the planet killed by air pollution that causes heart disease, cancer, and lung disease.
For much more on that story and the ones we couldn't get to today, I'm sure there's some happy ones in there somewhere. Please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find us and follow us on the Facebook and the Twitters at Green News Report. From bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
When will we ever learn?
Hey, 18 minutes past the hour. This is hour two of this Titanic Tuesday edition of The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid, and I thought you might be interested in, there were 6 Democrats in the vote on this toxic bill today who voted in favor of it. I thought you might like to know, just in case you might happen to live where they are, who they are. Let's see, who is, look here, here's one right now. Here's a Democrat who stuck a shiv between the ribs of little Appalachian children trying to breathe clean air and drink clean water. Thanks, Ann Kirkpatrick of the 1st District of Arizona, voting aye. And, of course, we always have thanks to send out to Nick Rahal for, man, what is the next generation going to think of old Nick Joe? Well, he got his. F us. Let's see, who else did? Okay, here's a weird one. Anybody, any members of the California contingent of the Horn Family Commune want to explain this to me? Who is, and I got to scroll down to it, who is Jim Costa of California's 16th District who professes to be a Democrat and yet put the long, sharp one to children and mamas and daddies in Appalachia today? He's an I vote. He's one of the, so we got 2 out of 3. We got 3 out of 6 so far. I found a couple of other ones. John Barrow of Georgia, allegedly a Democrat. He is said to be a bit of a fossil because he's one of the last, if not the last, remaining conservative white Southern Democrats. John Barrow. And then, because I know, you out there, Ron? Or anybody else in North Carolina? How's about? Would you care to explain to me, Mike McIntyre? That's 5. Who's Mike McIntyre, and why does he so despise little children? Little children in the womb in Appalachia, why is that? What's he got against us? Yeah, there's Nick Rahal. No surprise. And there he is. There's our 6th turncoat. And look, he's a family values guy. Jim Matheson, Democrat of Utah, stand back there behind the Zion curtain. Yeah. So there's your 6. Now, what's interesting, there were a couple of no votes. There were 7 Republican no votes. Joyce Beatty. No, wrong. She's a Democrat. Looking at the wrong color. Oh, well, I don't have time. I just thought you'd like to know who the Democrats are. But before going to the phones, and lines are open, 304-658-3333, I wanted to share something with you that I got today from the Internet's most brilliant satirist, my dear friend Eugene Finnerman. You can sign up for his RDA of Irony over at Finnerman Works, FinnermanWorks.com. Eugene remarked today, now that we have a new Cold War, let's reminisce about the old one. Eugene has one of those brilliant historical minds that where the neurons fire pretty much at their own pace and of their own free will. And well, he was just reminded of a little something-something today, now, as he notes, now that we have a new Cold War. This goes back to July the 24th, 1959, something called the Kitchen Debate. Eugene notes that back then the Cold War was fought over a dishwasher at the U.S. Trade Fair in Moscow. Dueling in a model kitchen over the respective merits of their ideologies were Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev and Vice President Richard Milhouse Pinhead, according to Harry Truman, Nixon. Each man was the champion and personification of his system. Khrushchev was a vulgar, cunning peasant who, through ruthlessness and guile, rose to the apex of power. Nixon had more hair. Eugene remarks, although there are transcripts of the kitchen debate, here's what they really meant. Nixon, we call this a dishwasher. In America, people have more than one dish. Khrushchev, communist people are proud to wash their dishes. We gather around the basin and sing folk songs. Lenin took special pride in cleaning samovars. Well, this is a refrigerator. It keeps food cold and from spoiling. We have something similar called climate. It is great for food and bad for invading armies. Oh, yes, I've heard. Yes, I've heard the 1812 Overture. You must be proud of Tchaikovsky. Our fairies only write show tunes, and most of them are Jews. Russian ones, I believe. Well, they didn't mind leaving. Now, this is an electric range. It's an oven and a stove combined. You can simultaneously bake and boil beets. Finally, there will be some variety to your diet. Actually, these days we are getting lots of Hungarian goulash, German potato salad, and Bulgarian yogurt, the same way you get Latin American bananas, sugar, and coffee. I really don't see value of all these decadent gadgets. So you can bug them. It's so easy to plant microphones in all these appliances. Really, Nick, I thought you'd understand. The kitchen is the perfect place to eavesdrop on your citizens. Families gathered over a meal and forced to talk to each other. Their guard is down. Find out what they really think. Let them incriminate themselves. We bug bedrooms. J. Edgar Hoover would be a problem. He thinks that sex is a criminal activity. We want to arrest people for treason, not the missionary position. Beria could be the same way. So we shot him. You know, in some ways, your system is superior. The Kitchen Debate, 1959. Everything old is new again. Thank you, Eugene. Brilliantly done. Oh, okay. Thank you, Ron and Raleigh. Mike McIntyre. Mike McIntyre is a Dino, Democrat in name only, from the western part of the state that is it's a conservative district, and he's up for re-election. He usually votes with the Repiglicans. So that's no surprise then, in other words, Ron. Thank you very much. I always appreciate the efforts of our individual correspondents when we have moments of congressional confusion. 26 past the hour. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Still feel that way?
More and more so, Bill. More and more so.
Well, I was sitting here laughing. That was a piece of work.
Oh, the kitchen debate?
Yeah, I remember that kitchen debate. Well, I was alive when it happened.
I like Eugene's version better.
Oh, it's so true. I mean, dishwasher. Yeah, well, we had those, buddy. I'll tell you, when I was in that good Catholic children's home, we could wash dishes and quick time, my friend. Listen, they were prepping us for the Army, you know, whether we knew it or not. I guess they were getting us ready for that. You know, get them trained young. Man, that place is going down the tubes. I mean, the nuns were a pain in the ass, but they had some psychologist or psychology student or some kind of idiot. And Bob, he was pimping out a 13-year-old girl.
No, oh, Jesus.
Yeah. I wonder what... I hope these nuns come back and haunt this son of a bitch. Because they were bad enough when they were alive, but man, the spirits, that would be it. Because those boys in them...
The question is, do they get to come back from in the afterlife? Do they get to bring their rulers with them?
Yeah, that's true. That was a big honor in the Catholic Church Bob, I went out there and started doing altar boy stuff. I thought, well, Bill, do you want to be a priest? Well, I guess I was, but the religion was drink up, because the more you drink, the better we sound.
I was going to say that the religion was 80 proof.
Yeah, that was about it, you know, and, God. You're on the money tonight. These guys, what kills me is, where are these so-called Democrats coming from? I wish I could read between the lines on some of these people and get...
Well, I'm waiting on word from the California contingent.
Money, but you know.
I'm waiting on the word from the California contingent on Costa, and word from the Arizona contingent on this. What's her name here? Ann Kirkpatrick.
What is it with these people? What they call themselves? Democrats, get the hell out of here. Change. Go and call yourself what you really are voting. Always in the bottom line, Bob, there's just no...
This much I can tell you, as far as Nick Rahal is concerned, I don't think we're going to have to worry about him after November. Yeah, and make no mistake, it's not like he's going to be replaced by some sane progressive alternative. He will be replaced by a teabagger who will make Nick Rahal's drooling solicitude for the coal industry look tame.
You know, we thought we had buried the Berkshires years ago. We thought we had put a stop to their crap because they were just hilarious to deal with and sit there and, sit there when they're, what's the term you like to use, the old colonial term, speechifying. When they were going, you know, we cut them their ribbons later because they were easy. People who get lockstepped into something used to be easy to, because I heard plenty of it from the left, too. When you got into the arguing of the Vietnam War, these guys basically, and I can understand what they were doing, they were arguing because they didn't want to go.
Yeah.
I don't blame them for that, but it's like what they should have been arguing about after they... What the hell were we doing there? And this is what bothers me now. Well, what are these people talking about to get involved in this Ukrainian crisis? Are they kidding me? Are they that ignorant, Bob, that they don't know the nuclear arsenal these guys are sitting on? Or did the Russians secretly destroy everything and I didn't know about it,
No, neither of us, no. No, we've just, look, the measure, Bill, the measure of right-wing dumbassery almost requires a different kind of mathematics. Maybe that's what's behind the mathematics of Common Core, is teaching children to figure out just how godforsaken stupid Republicans really are.
And they used to be the upper-class party when I was a kid. That's what they were. They were the... that's another story. One woman who was really served at Dien Bien Phu, taking care of wounded on the French side of the thing, she ended up coming to the States, and she went to Congress. She was invited there. The woman who was the House of Representatives from out one county away from me, out in the... What the hell was her name? Oh, God, she was an old battle axe. I think she replaced her husband, who was a member of the House from Hawk. She invited this woman, and the woman was observing things in Congress, and Congress stopped and turned around and applauded the woman. It's like, I would applaud her personally because of the courage and the ability she showed saving wounded men, dying men. Yeah, that's I hope to God, I hope to whatever, if I ever was faced with this kind of stuff, I had the courage to be able to do it. But, you know, what the hell was she doing addressing Congress at all, speaking to him?
Oh.
She gave speech to him.
Bail
me out on the old lady.
I'm no help there. It'll happen in a minute via email or in the chat room, and
I'm always asking people because I don't have me and email me and the internet aren't working too well together.
Went away in a hurry.
Well, my number one computer guy, he's so busy with, you know, light living that, and he's done so much for you already, so you can't say anything. You know, you don't want to be bugging a guy that to do your thinking for you, you know. And it bugs me because in the early 90s, I was assembling the damn things myself. But the guy never taught me to configure, damn it. I wish he had at the time because I would have, you know, been in it deeper. The more you know,
Yeah, exactly.
Sometimes I wonder, but, you know, this whole idea of a major war, I just got a copy of The 1 Minute to Midnight. Right now I'm working on that Chinese American's book on Nanking. And you want to lose weight? Read that.
Well, that's what I meant when I was talking earlier about how Churchill was talking about, you know, arming for war, you know, Europe arming for war. I guess what was going on in Manchuria and the rest of China just didn't count.
Yeah.
You know, Churchill, you know, had a real blind spot for people who weren't white.
True enough. When, you know, I think I mentioned the fact that when the Japanese seized Burma, tons of rice that were being shipped to India. Well, guess what? They weren't making it anymore. And I think India took a 300,000 or 600,000 person loss due to famine. And of course, Stalin did that to the Ukrainians too. Yeah, old Churchill. He had all kinds of ideas. He contacted the Russians about dropping 2 million men on the north coast of Germany, about 75, 80 miles from Berlin, see? And he was going to use, he was going to build a fleet of seagoing monitors. They're going to revive that thing, huh? I guess they never got rid of it in Europe at some place, the Austrians had a flotilla on the Danube of the damn thing.
Well, they could, I can see where they could be handy in riverine situations.
Yeah.
Of course, my favorite is that, during World War II, Churchill came up with the idea of trying to cut some icebergs loose and turn them into aircraft carriers.
Yeah, I remember that story.
And just let them sort of bob, in the Atlantic southward until such time as they melted. And then I guess the planes would fly away.
Well, they were trying to think PY. K-R-E-T was, I think, the spelling of it. They were going to use this as a forwarding aircraft carrier. And somebody at a conference shot the damn thing with a pistol, and the bullet went ricocheting around. And luckily, it didn't hit anybody, but what kind of a moron does that? And they were in a high position. Okay, next. It just amazes me, the stupidity. And how can these people vote the way that bunch voted, all those Democrats, maybe they're in real tight situations voting-wise.
I don't know, but I have the whole list now. Sparky looked it up for me, or for us, more appropriately. Looked it up for us, and it's John Barrow of Georgia. Okay, we know why him. Sanford Bishop of Georgia. Probably something, I don't know. Jim Costa of California. I don't know where the 16th district is, but I imagine we'll be figuring it out soon enough. Henry Cuellar of Texas.
What?
Yeah, Henry Cuellar. Anne Kirkpatrick of Arizona. Jim Matheson of Utah. He probably votes with the Republicans most of the time anyway. He's from Utah. Mike McIntyre, whom Ron has explained. Colin Peterson of Minnesota. Minnesota's 7th District. Need to hear from the Minnesota contingent of the Horn Family Commune, if you'd care to take a run at explaining that. And then, of course, Nick Rahel and Bobby Scott of Virginia's 3rd District.
Yeah.
That's a little troubling. Now, here's something even more interesting. There were 7 Republicans who voted against this bill. Mike Fitzpatrick of Pennsylvania and David Reichert of Washington. Okay? Those two are actually endorsed routinely by the Sierra Club. So that's kind of, that makes a little sense. Chris Gibson of New York's 19th District, Jamie Herrera Butler of Washington's 3rd District, Frank Lobiondo of New Jersey's 2nd District, Chris Smith of the New Jersey 4th, and Frank Wolf of the Virginia 10th.
I mean, you say, what's in it for them? Are they on the
well, field? I don't know. I think somewhere along the way that Merlot-sodden tanning bed junkie boner will probably have something to say about it.
Well, that guy, don't even start me. You know, I have a, don't mention a bar owner to me, because bar owners are not, you know, I spent a lifetime dealing with those folks. And they are not fun, to say the least. Do you have a following? Yeah, but I don't think bill collectors come out to see you when you play, do they? Following, yeah. There's some buddies of mine are playing. They played a place 2 weeks in a row.
Hey, hit the tip jar. The guy owes me money.
Yeah, exactly. And when I sent a contract to one guy, he said, well, why are you doing this? I said, why won't you sign it? Well, I don't sign it. Well, bye. Or another guy was in a, he was a, the last part of his name, and ye shall find, so you can figure out the first part of his name. He was an East Indian fella, and, he owned a strip club. Now, that's a, you know, I learned early, my dad was doing booking, and he was, he stopped booking dancers in bars. He said, Bill, I can't stand it, you know. He told me later when I was like 16 or 17 that he didn't, you know, if I know the old man, he dated a few of them, too. If he's anything like his son, like his father. But, you know, the bottom line being that he couldn't do it anymore because it was just, what was expected of him. So this guy owned one of those places, and he bought a place downtown near that famous new stadium that the taxpayers of the city paid for. And he books me, and he cancels the same next week, or the day he's supposed to go, he cancels to that morning, and they did that twice. And then he sends me a check that's hot. But my second wife having a connection with the sheriff of the county due to her work at the battered women's shelter, I took care of the guy because the guy didn't know that that was a third degree felony, whether he knew it or not. So writing a check on an account that wasn't open.
Ooh.
Yeah. So he paid me, and then to show what kind of an idiot I am, I never showed up at all. 2 people can play the game. The check was cashed and in the account, and heck with you, buddy. Creep. That was my problem, the cynicism of the business. Here's the good part is his high spirituality of playing something, you know, producing music, and then the low reality was, my God, the things you have to do. But then again, you've known as many guys in the country field as the whoever sent in the raise. I'm moving on. I wish you would pick up a copy of the first thing that turned me on to Ray in the middle of the night. Thing called Lonely Avenue, and the thing about Lonely Avenue was written by a white kid from Brooklyn who had I think he walked with a crutch, and I forget the guy's name. I'm forgetting everything, Bob, don't ask me. But anyway, I won't keep you, but it's just, they just keep piling on this crap, and they're burying their own nation. And don't give a damn whether they're doing it or not. But as I say, I'll go back to old Bobby Lee, treasonous SOB that he might have been, when he talked about the Confederate Congress in 1864. He sounded like one of us talking about the Congress of our own country today, you know?
Yeah.
I guess, right or wrong, something, but no matter what your cause is, some people will never change. And old Khrushchev, I still have to kiss his hand, him and Kennedy in 1962, or none of us would be sitting here throwing the words around, you know? And I told him, I hate to think of what would happen to the guy. And that's what bothers me. This might be, I don't care if it happens long after I'm gone. There's a lot of people I still care about, you know?
Precisely.
And
that's that generational thing Bismarck was talking about.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, that man was smart enough to start Social Security in German for the workers.
And workers' comp, and, yeah.
Yep. He needed those
workers. The modern social safety net was invented by Bismarck.
Aristocratic son of a war man that he was. Maybe his bottom line was that if you take care of the workers, they'll keep working and keep producing. And
no, I think his bottom line was, I saw what happened in 1848, and I don't want it to be 1793, so let's try to forestall that. He was an extremely practical man.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a certain amount of truth to, I mean, I don't know, these are people, but, you know, Hitler didn't just walk into power. He had a lot of assistance from the money crowd over there. And, like I say, the one guy that I can't remember, I never remember his name anymore, he wrote a book, but he was the guy that Hitler wanted. He didn't care if the whole country was destroyed totally, and this guy did whatever he could to not let it go that bad, but,
Oh, and by the way, Sandra with a note, Val Kilmer.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. All right, Bill, have yourself a good night.
Hey, you take care, my friend. Good night.
All right, talk to you soon. Bye now.
Yeah.
Our buddy Bill, Mr. Stress, calling from Cleveland. See, isn't it nice to have a functioning appreciation of history? Because it makes the present so much more comprehensible. By the way, before I go back to the lines, a couple of explanations coming in. One, via Marty, the 16th Congressional District in California extends as far north as Turlock, as far south as southern Fresno. It's an agricultural area, kind of like the area that produces a Conservadam or a Dino, like the one, one Gary Condit. Remember him? So a pattern emerges. You've got a blue doggy person in the form of Costa, and then lo and behold, look, another blue dog. Henry Cuellar, Texas Betsy informs me, supporter of gun rights, an opponent of abortion rights, one of two blue dog Democrats in Texas's congressional delegation. According to his campaign website, his top priorities are accessibility to constituents, education, health care, supporting veterans, serving seniors, providing for small businesses, enhancing homeland security, ensuring border security, advancing trade, and taking any other action that supports hard-working families and individuals, unless, of course, it means voting against a Republican bill that poisons hard-working Americans and families and individuals. He voted no on the Ryan budget, Medicare choice, tax and spending cuts, voted no on repealing the Prevention and Public Health Slush Fund, voted yes on regulating tobacco as a drug, voted yes on expanding, Blue Dog. And the question arises, and I think it's a question we've been asking since 2010, what the hell good is a blue dog? Not damned much. Back to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, it's John. How you doing?
Hey, John, how are you?
I'm okay.
You've been on the road some, I know.
Yeah, I've been on the road a lot the last couple of weeks. But, you know, it's been good stuff. And I'm sorry, I'm just joining now, and so I don't know if this has been sort of on the topic or not, but I kind of wanted to talk a bit about the latest instance of the Gulf of Mexico being a giant sacrifice zone.
You mean the Galveston Bay dump?
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly what it is, and I feel a little bit sheepish about this because my outrage is largely because that's my home. I mean, that's where I come from. That's my natal land.
Well, don't feel sheepish about that. I wouldn't be if I wasn't around here. I don't reckon I'd get near as burned up about mountaintop removal.
Yeah, and I guess that's sort of where the sheepish comes from, and I am, that issue is on my radar because of this program. So I guess the piece I make is that I'd like to just talk a little bit about Southeast Texas and what's going on there, because I think this is another case of sort of media ignoring another forgotten part of this country. What's going on here? If we can just do a little Southeast Texas geography. The Houston Ship Channel, right? Houston's like the fourth largest city in the country. It's one of the busiest ports in the world. And this barge that was carrying oil got rammed 4 days ago and has leaked about 170,000 gallons of oil into the Houston Ship Channel. Now, that means into the Gulf of Mexico. So the last thing in the world the Gulf of Mexico needs is another oil spill. This is the same place where the Deepwater Horizon spill happened. And I'm irate about this for a lot of reasons. Like I said, the first of them is that when I was growing up for 18 years, we spent, you know, every summer down on the Upper Texas coast. The Houston Ship Channel, this great big bay, you know, leading to the port of Houston, and you get into it by going through big oil tankers, et cetera, by threading their way through about a 3-mile-wide deep water channel between Galveston Island and a little peninsula of land called Bolivar Peninsula. Bolivar Peninsula is what we call it. It's named after Simón Bolívar, of course.
I was guessing.
Latin American revolutionary hero. Right, exactly. And we would summer, we would go down to see, to live with our grandparents for a week every summer on Bolivar Peninsula. Bolivar Peninsula is in the pathway. There's dead oil-covered birds washing up on the beaches I played on when I was a kid. And it just, it hits close to home. It makes me upset. And I think that the last thing in the world that the poor people on Bolivar Peninsula need is something like this. And it's just frustrating. The lack of attention to this is frustrating. And it's just, it's a piece of what's been happening down there for years. Nobody remembers Hurricane Ike. Back in 2008, Hurricane Ike landed on Bolivar Peninsula. There's about 2,400 households on the peninsula. It's about 30 miles long, you know, leading down to Galveston Bay. Every single building on the peninsula was impacted. There was 20 feet of water covering Bolivar Peninsula for days after Hurricane Ike. Only about 60% of the people that lived there in 2007 are back there after this hurricane. And then Deepwater Horizon happened, and then this happened. And it's like, how much abuse do these people need in the name of progress and development and energy?
No, I believe me.
From here?
No,
of course
I,
you do.
I get it. I get it all. I think you and I exist on a similar plane, John. When we talk about policy choices being made in Washington, they're choices that are made by people who are elected and sent there.
Mm-hmm.
And so, do the people of the Bolivar Peninsula, do they know who or do they have a responsible member of Congress and they just happen to be in the way of money?
Well, for a long time, that's part of Galveston County, and for a long time, they were represented by Ron Paul. Does that tell you anything?
Oh, Jesus.
Mm-hmm. This is not.
So everybody's got. We'll go on the gold standard, and we'll and if it, you know, gold with a little oil on it, just, you know, that just makes it more fun.
Oh, it's tasty. Yeah, and these are folks who are in general older than the population at large. And per capita income on the peninsula is half of the U.S. average, but they're dependable Republican voters.
So they're doing it to themselves.
I hate to say that. I hate to say that so much. And I mean that, you know.
Well, I do. I do too. But you know, I live up here where people say, "Why don't you move?"
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I say because I want to stand and fight.
Yeah.
Because it's in my nature, even if I kind of object to the fight metaphor.
Yeah,
I have a human right to place.
Mm-hmm.
Even if through a semi-democratic process, people decide that they don't want their own right to place.
Yeah.
And it's hellishly hard to see something like that happen to home. But you know, it's kind of like earlier today during the floor debate on this let's poison more hillbillies bill. You know, here's a teabagging Republican from Louisiana named Steve Scalise, who, and I'm not kidding, since you said you were just catching up, stood up in this debate and said, well, here it is, March in Washington, D.C., and it's snowing, and we're still worrying about climate change.
Oh, for God's sake.
Now, this guy, and when I say this, you know, I consider where you're talking about in Texas to be kith and kin with the culture, you know, the bayou culture of Louisiana.
Oh, it's fair. Absolutely. Yeah.
Here's a guy whose state, many portions of it, Louisiana, have been turned into a toxic waste dump, just like the Gulf Coast of Texas has.
Yeah.
And this guy wants to take time out of his busy day to make sure more hillbillies get poisoned? You know, I mean, it just drags me right back down there to the little old blue-haired ladies in the basement of the Baptist church saying, physician, heal thyself. But he doesn't care about them either. And yes, John, he gets returned to the Congress because he has family values and he wants a smaller government. In some ways, and it extends all the way from West Virginia to the Bolivar Peninsula and all parts in between, we really are dealing with people who want to re-litigate, if not refight, the Civil War. And they've smartened up enough to do it with laws instead of guns.
Yeah. I think that thread runs through both the places we're talking about. And I don't know where the blame for this lies. I mean, I really hate to sort of blame the folks who are doing the voting because they are being told what's been reinforced for them for so long. You know, I mean, it's
right, but I don't like to talk about complaints without at least acknowledging the possibility of a solution. So, if you and I are in the same, I think we're in the same neighborhood on that. And if that's the case, then the question arises: education. How do you educate? How do you explain to somebody that? Well, no, this isn't because we want to eat fetuses or anything. We would like for the fetuses to be able to grow up on their home ground.
Yeah.
I mean, your native soil really does mean something. I adhere to that, the no questions asked.
Yeah.
And so is it because of money? Well, they were electing Ron Paul before Citizens United ever came along, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean that's on them, but it's also because on you know the message Ron Paul was peddling and it resonated with what they've been brought up on. I mean, education. I think you're right. It's important. It's critical thinking. It's science. It's these sort of things. And I don't know. Maybe we've been tinkering with education policy forever, and it doesn't seem to have changed a lot. Maybe this Common Core is something to look at. I don't know. I don't pretend there's an easy answer to it. It's just I mean my call here is because of just outrage and frustration more than anything.
Yeah, it hurts.
Yeah.
It hurts. And you know, that's part and parcel of what has dominated the program this evening. It is painful to me. If not physically, then certainly emotionally and philosophically or spiritually or whatever word we want to use, to see some guy from Louisiana or some guy from Indiana or Ohio, or Washington State, okay? Washington State, stand up and say, we want to poison more Appalachian children. It makes me crazy. And I mention Washington State in particular because the guy who was fronting the debate on the House side of this, John, was Doc Hastings, a wild-eyed Republican from Washington State, where there are, even as I speak, 14 people dead, and I think 100 missing in a mudslide in that beautiful, beautiful mountainous state.
Oh, God. Okay. I didn't know that.
And
I assume Doc is not a title, it's a name?
He's a DOC doc.
Yeah.
I can think of another vowel and never mind. But here's a guy whose home state is in crisis right now because of, and I don't mean to diminish this by saying simple, but because of a simple mudslide.
Yeah.
And yet he's standing there saying, I want to make it more likely that an entire mud dam can break loose and send billions of gallons of toxic waste down the Coal River Valley. Now, to the extent that we talked about education, does he do that because he just doesn't give a hoot about Appalachian families who are also Americans? Or does he do it because he doesn't understand it? Or does he do it because he doesn't believe that earthen dams can break loose in a place, in a world where sometimes the mud on the mountain just falls down? I don't know. But these guys are always the same ones who are out there flogging their morality.
Yeah. I think there's two different things going on there. I mean, the morality is a cover for all this stuff, but the jobs, the economy stuff, I think is the powerful message, and it resonates with people because I don't need to tell you this. Everyone is precarious right now. The idea that if we don't listen to this guy, then there's not going to be any more jobs, and we don't have jobs anyway, so we can't put that at risk. And I think that's a powerful message right now that resonates with folks. When we have people, you know, dealing with debt, dealing with joblessness, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that the issue to solve is economic issues. I don't know what to do about that, but we're not going to be able to have people be able to think sort of beyond their immediate bread and butter, you know, food on the table issue until we can get some security for folks, which is why it's so striking that, you know, at least one party and maybe one and a half parties in Congress are opposing things that would be, you know, provide real relief and real choice and opportunity for folks.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm looking at a map right here right now as we're talking. By 86 years from now, we can expect the sea level of the Gulf of Mexico to have risen anywhere from 1 to 6 meters.
Okay, yeah.
What does that mean on the Bolivar Peninsula?
Oh, there's no more Bolivar Peninsula, but there's also no more Houston, no more Beaumont, no more Clear Lake,
no more Corpus Christi,
no more Corpus Christi, no more NASA, no more. Yeah, I mean that's all history. I mean, you know, those cities are at most 15 feet above sea level. Look, people have been in that part of Southeast Texas because it is a little slice of paradise for at least 10,000, probably more like 20,000 years. And we know this because where they were living is about 100 miles offshore now because, again, sea levels have risen. When they dredge, when they lay pipelines, they dig up evidence of past human habitation in Southeast Texas because it's always been a wonderful place to live.
Like so many places for the native peoples who lived here, John, once you sorted out how to live with the local climate, everything else on this continent was gravy.
Yeah. The issue down there is alligators. But, you know, once you deal with the gators, you're fine. In fact, they're delicious. But they didn't cause that problem.
Right. Is it inconceivable to imagine that, say, people, 2,000 years ago, here, and we're not talking about the ones who spoke Reformed Egyptian or anything.
Right, yeah.
Is it inconceivable to say that people who lived where we're talking about 2,000 years ago might be able to take a look at the sky and say, bad shit coming, head for high ground? Because once you've licked the hurricane season and the alligators, and maybe the occasional cottonmouth, Everything else is good.
Yes.
We're talking about leisure time, we're talking about creative time, we're talking about time to build communities and pass it. How many generations in 2,000, 5,000, 10,000 years?
Oh, tons and tons of generations. And, yeah, leisure time out the ass. I mean, you know, they probably worked about 15 hours a week, if that. You know, and everything else was, like you said, yeah, it was just gravy. It was enjoying your surroundings. It was building community. It was trading. It was going off into the marsh and doing whatever. Yeah. It's something we've lost to our detriment. And not only have we lost, but we seem to be accelerating the distance between that mode of life and this mode of life.
And I think a larger point beyond that is that, for instance, and of course, you know, all of my points of reference are back up here, John. The friends of coal will say, well, you just want to kill off the coal industry so we all freezes to death in the dark.
Uh-huh. Right.
10,000 years of not freezing to death in the dark.
Oh, 5 million years of not freezing to death in the dark.
Well,
yeah. we've solved how to live in the cold climates for a long time. Yeah, you know, okay, Northern Europe, fine. You know, 1.5 million years. Yeah, sure. Yeah, we know how to do that. We can't do it the way we live now.
But that's the second part of this bifurcated question.
Yeah.
Are we screwing ourselves so badly that even if there were to be some distant or not cultural collapse of a global scale, that we wouldn't even be able to return to that kind of living? And by that I mean where, you know, the water isn't fit to drink.
Yeah.
You know, how long would it take? Let's say the Keystone XL boys get their way and we build that damn pipeline, it ruptures, ruins the Ogallala Aquifer. How long will it take for the Ogallala Aquifer to perk out the poison?
Oh God, I can't even imagine.
Yeah, doesn't that just make you want to run screaming into the night?
It's terrifying. I mean, we are if nothing else, an adaptable species. But I mean, what would happen is that we would be faced with foreshortened, stunted, you know, miserable lives with, you know, problems in reproduction and birth and living. I mean, it would be a horrible existence. It's not like being able to go back to nature when something like that happens. It's going back to nature with, you know, most of the deck stacked against you. It's a difficult thing to contemplate.
Well, and I say that because I'm never going to have the patience to sit down and write a novel, fantasy, science fiction, what have you.
Yeah.
But I've had for years, John, this vision of 1,000 years from now, and I'm not perceptive enough to know what the culture will look like 1,000 years from now. But I have this vision of a wandering band of humans walking through Appalachia and coming upon a big lake.
Yeah.
And thinking, well, we're going to stop here. We'll fish. You know, we'll do what we have. And they all die. Because it's the Brushy Fork impoundment, and it's full of coal toxins that are still there 1,000 years from now, which it will be.
Right.
What chance does any remnant of humanity have against that?
It's really like nothing we've ever faced before. I don't know. I mean, the only solution to avert that sort of crisis, that sort of horror, is to fix what we're doing right now. And I feel so stupid saying this because it's like, wait, okay, so smart guy, what's your solution? Well, I don't know. I mean, that is the end result of the road that we're on currently. And if that's the future.
Yeah, right. And exactly. Because, among those ancient peoples we were talking about, It's this kind of goes back to that essay that I sent to you. What was that? Reading for Survival?
Yes, McGee. Yeah.
John D. McDonald. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you can find it if anybody who wants to read this, just go out and look up Reading for Survival, John D. McDonald. You'll find it.
Oh, please do. It's profound. Yeah.
There is a transmittable wisdom like don't pet the water moccasin. Don't try to pet the water moccasin.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? That's easily transmittable for millions of years. And it's the kind of thing that an orally transmitted wisdom can handle. Don't eat those berries. Don't pet the rattlesnake.
Yeah.
On the other hand, we have created a world, John, in which there is no way to transmit in written form or in oral form how to build an industrial society that will then build a Geiger counter that will then tell you not to drink the water out of the pool at the old fallen apart nuclear power plant.
Yes, exactly. And just think about how incongruous it is to say, you know, not just don't pet the water moccasin, but don't drink the water, don't breathe the air, don't eat the fish out of the pond because they'll kill you. That's a rupture with anything we've ever experienced before.
Well, that way lies, and in fact, I got some email pitch today, and I couldn't quite tell if it was right wing or left wing, for somebody who is out there pondering the sixth great extinction event. And I couldn't help but thinking of our friends, the Mayan peoples, who said that the world has been destroyed five times. And they said, you know, there were volcanoes, there were floods, there was wind, there was water, earthquakes.
Yeah.
Well, oddly enough, somebody out there has determined that there have been five great extinction events on this planet since its formation. You know, 6,000 okay. years ago. No.
You're correct.
You know, one of them would be the asteroid that struck near the Yucatan that took down a bunch of the saurian species.
Yeah, okay.
Another, maybe the first great glaciation. I know they mentioned the asteroid. Not so sure about the glaciation. But that there have been six events that came perilously close to wiping out life on the planet.
Sure, the Great Cambrian extinction. Yeah, sure. Okay.
And what they're saying is that for the first time, and that's what makes me think this was a little bit leftish, that for the first time we are facing the sixth greatest extinction event, and for the first time it is an event that is entirely created by one species.
Hmm. Okay.
And I think you've probably seen, and I've seen that one sort of speculative piece that says, well, you know, after everybody's dead, after all the humans are gone, Earth will be just fine, and nature will come right back.
Yeah.
Yeah, I call bullshit.
I'm doubtful. Right, exactly.
If anything, you know, maybe what you get is what I've referenced in the past, the 6-foot-tall race of sentient cockroaches who live on number 2 field grade corn. I don't
yeah,
know.
And nothing against them or the cockroaches or whatever, but you know, I kind of want us to stick around a bit. I think we've done a lot of good things.
I'm undeniably humanocentric, anthropocentric.
I am anthropocentric. Yeah, it's a problem with some of my students, but yeah, no, I'm with you on that. And it's
yeah, I mean, if I can't be here, I want somebody to be here who can look back and say, you know, look what the well, and the way my mind works, I have a feeling that if we survive, there will be people who look back and say, you know, the Doc Hastingses and the Steve Scalises and the John Boehners and the Mitch McConnells tried to kill off humanity.
Yeah.
But they failed because of Dr. John. And they failed because of Bob.
Yeah.
And they failed because of Kate in Montana.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying?
I hear you.
Maybe we're working on our own deification, John. Who knows?
I like it, especially when you spread it around the commune.
Exactly. No egomaniac I.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for the chance to vent.
Oh, it's wonderful hearing from you. Are you back home now or back at school or?
Yeah, back at school.
Yeah.
Home will come later.
Yeah, I know. Well, you know, continue to do the good things you were doing with the young minds, Dr. John.
Oh. I will try. All right, cheers, Bob. I'll talk to you later.
All right, take care. And that is Dr. John, and there's no end of places whence that man's mind goeth. And I hope, like you, or like me, you feel we are the better for it. Diane in Kansas stand with a note. She says, I'm learning from Dr. John's report about Southeast Texas. What occurs to me is that our future may be so chock full of forgotten regions that we will have to engage in collective denial on an unprecedented scale to avoid dealing with it all. Or we as a species could frickin' wake up. And see, there's Diane out in Kansas stand doing, you know, doing her best to wake up, you know. And you can't, and I know I've mentioned this before, and you can't just blow by the people in Kansas stand and West Virginia, in Texas, in Kentucky, in Alafreakin Bama, in Tennessee, in North Carolina, South Carolina. You can't just blow by the people there who are screaming, wake up. Because you really, really, really don't know whose voice is going to be the one that gets heard. Now, we live in a world where the loudest voice is generally the voice that has the most money. Witness the colloquy that we had on last night's Moran Monday. Witness the colloquy between David Gregory and David Brooks, really, Edith? About how you can't just invade somebody else's country and not a damn bit of irony, nothing. Just beep. But every voice counts. And that's why this model exists here. It's conversation radio. The people who form the Horn family commune have important things to say that would not get said somewhere else where, hi, you know, you're on the EIB network. Well, thank you, Rush. I just want to tell you that I think you're the neatest thing since Daddy took the training wheels off my tricycle. Well, that's enough about you. Let's talk about me. By comparison, if you think back to the ancient world, oh God, there he goes again. If you think back to the ancient world, literacy did not exist at the levels that it does now, and even now we bemoan the level of literacy such as it does exist. And even so, we treasure every scrap of writing that we get out of the ancient world. And this, again, please go download Dr. Bill's program from earlier today, because I didn't really mean to, or maybe he had some sort of subliminal effect on me. But here we are, back to what Dr. Bill was talking about today. By the way, Dr. Bill will be going live at 3 p.m. Eastern time tomorrow because he's got an evening meeting he has to attend. Dr. Bill was talking about this idea of trying to sort out purpose in life and worth and why we're here. The stuff that has bedeviled the ancients and bedevils us now, and the only people who aren't bedeviled by it are the people who are busy with Here Comes Honey, Boo Boo Child, or pick one. You know, idle minds are the devil's plaything, right? But this reminds me of something that I saw last week. A story that came out about a scrap of papyrus. Our word paper does come from papyrus, doesn't it? Not just the idea, but the word itself. Scraps of papyrus found in the Baltics. And they were left lie because they were in such a poor state of existence. Their decomposition was so profound that there really wasn't anything that the people who found them could do with them. But they at least had the foresight to tuck them away and say, maybe someday somebody can. And they had no idea what it was. It may have been an ancient Roman recipe for broth of guts. But because it was ancient, it had relevance. Or at least it had value. Yeah, as Irish Dave notes, maybe it was the written recipe for beer and bread. There's more of that essential transmission of basic knowledge. Here's how to make bread. Here's how to make beer. Don't pet the rattlesnake. So it lays around for 100 years, and an aspiring academic gets hold of it. The story is, I mean, there's pictures and everything, but the story's over at Live Science. And back at the beginning of this month, when I read this story, tears came to my eyes. Probably because I am badly in need of medication. A newly deciphered letter home, dating back around 1800 years. So, yeah, that would be the heady days of the middle of the Roman Empire. Reveals the pleas of a young Egyptian soldier named Aurelius Pollion, who was serving probably as a volunteer in a Roman legion in Europe, because, you see, back then they had a poverty draft, too. Joining the legions was a way out of poverty. Not getting killed was really the key to the benefits plan. But if you could survive, maybe somebody would settle you on a parcel of land and you could spend your golden years digging away at the dirt trying to eke out a living. Whereas otherwise you might have just starved to death or been killed in mob violence in the city or what have you. In the letter, written mainly in Greek, Pollion tells his family that he is desperate to hear from them and that he is going to request leave to make the long journey back home to see them. It turns out his mother was a bread seller. He wrote to her, his sister, and his brother, and he said, "I pray that you are in good health, right, night and day, and I always make obeisance before all the gods on your behalf. I do not cease writing to you, but you do not have me in mind. I'm worried about you because although you received letters from me often, you never wrote back to me so that I may know how you," and, you know, that's where part of the letter got torn up. And he references the fact that he's written 6 letters to his family, and they haven't responded to any of them. And he's worried that something awful has happened to the family. "While away in Pannonia, I sent letters to you, but you treat me so as a stranger. I shall obtain leave from the consular, and I shall come to you so that you may know that I am your brother." It turns out the letters were found in an Egyptian town. He, however, was serving in Pannonia. You can look it up on a map where Pannonia was. And that's precious. That is literally the definition of priceless. Although I'm sure there's some Koch brother who'd like to put it behind glass or in a vacuum-sealed vault where only he could see it and would therefore be willing to put a price on it because money. This has relevance to all of humanity. To everyone who has ever been away from loved ones, and even in the modern age, when the phone rings and is not answered, or when letters go unresponded to. And there's nobody on earth who can't, to some degree or another, identify with that. And so we have that. but we're living in a world that seems to be working hammer and tongs at making sure that nothing like that is left of us. That nothing is left of us. By the way, credit where credit is due, Grant Adamson is a doctoral candidate at Rice University, and he found the papyrus and started using infrared imaging to make the letters come out and then translated it. They published it in the Bulletin of American Society of Papyrologists. Yes, there is one of those. But don't worry, some budget goober somewhere is probably trying to get rid of the Department of Papyrology at Rice University. Well, it's a private school, but... So all we know is that somebody got the letters in Egypt. I mean, we even know that he was part of Legio Duo Adiutrix that was stationed in Pannonia, which is around modern-day Hungary. And yet, suddenly, 1,800 years later, young Aurelius Pollyon has a voice. No, Irish Dave, it wasn't written on rice paper. So think about that. We don't know what all of this, every last bit of the technological aspect of the culture in which we live hangs so fragilely. That it becomes less and less likely that things will be preserved, unless there's a deliberate effort. I still have, and I've mentioned it before, I still have the bill that the obstetrician sent to my parents for my birth. I think I was a $25 baby, if not a $15 baby. And it's stored away. And periodically, I look at our children, and I say, there are things that are saved that you too must save. And I hope we're getting through. True, true, Asa with an observation. He says, yes, we treasure every bit of ancient writing except for when we elect a right-wing government who burn libraries across the country. Iraq? Anybody? Yeah, we've got an anniversary going on right now. We were so busy sending troops in Iraq to guard the oil ministry that we didn't care much about those exemplars of the very first evidences of actual writing that were on clay tablets that were knocked to the floors in the Baghdad Museum and were returned to their, well, you know, dust to dust. Just, you know, something to consider. So remember, when you call this program, you know, the archives are at White Rose Society. And I think Ben is Ben is obsessive compulsive enough that he backs this stuff up and he saves a second copy. I got a copy here. Who knows? If I could figure out some way to carve him into stone, shut up. But one never knows what will be here or how long or when. Who knows, it's possible your voice or your email being read aloud. Oh, which one of us might be Aurelius Pollyon? All right. to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Good evening. How are you doing?
Hey, Jim. How are you?
I was just listening to the tail end of what you said about, oh, collectibles of our lives and how they're recorded or recorded. You know, what was it, a Voyager? They had this huge disc and all our sounds and stuff like that that were sent off to outer space.
Yeah. It really did get me thinking when Dr. Bill was talking earlier today about his friend, all of whose writings and papers and effects were simply shoveled into garbage bags and carried away after she had passed on.
Well, that is indeed regrettable. I mean, that's just unconscionable that someone would do that. But there are people who do stuff like that.
Happens about thousands of times a day around here.
Well, I mean, you know, it's happened in the past. Remember what, oh, God, back in the days of early Egyptology when they would take mummies and stuff like that and grind them up in the dust and sell them as medicine in England?
Oh, yeah. And then, of course, there, the scholarship we have of the ancient world, in many cases, papyrus was just left, or leaves out of bound books and folios were left in a stack to be burned when it got cold.
Yep, unfortunately, it's just incredible how much knowledge was lost when, for example, the library at Alexandria was burned.
Well, is it St. Catherine's, the monastery out in the middle of the Sinai desert?
It is.
It was there that some pages were saved from the flames. That turned out to be the oldest examples of some biblical books.
Right. Now, that monastery, if I'm not mistaken, is still in existence and still working and thriving, and they have all kinds of things there. And I think it was built supposedly near one of the sites of the Mount Sinai or something that had to do with...
Right. It was supposedly built on the site of the burning bush.
Right. So basically, you know, these people throughout the centuries have attempted to restore and preserve as best they can and pass on to somebody who might, you know, collect these things. You know, I'm an avid collector of all kinds of stuff. And this is something that happened to me, and I'm sure some of the people listening will laugh, but I had this plate done by the Homer Laughlin Company, which is in West Virginia. And back in the late 30s, they were trying to throw in the Depression some business Homer Laughlin's way. And they did beautiful plates of the commemorative of the 1939 World's Fair. And the other day, somebody came in through the door.
Oh, no.
A chip.
Oh, I thought you were going to tell me a million pieces.
Well, it, number one, it can never replace the value because of how I got it. Number two, I just really couldn't say a whole lot. I found a replacement with a back chip for, you know, a lot less than what the other
one. Yeah, yours was mint, though, right?
Exactly. They both were mint. And, you know, and I thought, you know, the Homer Laughlin Company, I mean, I love their stuff. They can do Fiesta, and I collect Fiesta like crazy. I mean, I have more Fiesta in this house than probably, I don't know, I've just been collecting all my years. But, you know, I've always had the greatest respect for West Virginia craftsmanship and the Homer Laughlin people. They do such beautiful work. And they did exemplary work on a lot of the stuff that were used as souvenirs from the 1939 World's Fair. Now, that's not long ago. But when you think of what's happened in the world since 1939, and you think of the hands that have handled those souvenirs, the ones that I have in my possession, and what happened in their families, I mean, I was just thinking, 1939, the world tomorrow. And, of course, who knew that within 6 months, the entire world would be involved in...
It would be a whole lot of... there would be a much different tomorrow.
Yep. Not the world of tomorrow, that's for sure. But But, but those symbols, the trilon and the perisphere, have always been a great deal to me. And I don't know why. It's because of my mother and having gone to the fair and brought these things home. But she knew one day, and my sister could have cared less. I mean, and she was doing this, that, and the other. And the thing always fascinated me about the fair and what it meant and how it envisioned a lot of the things that we have today. I mean, you know, television and all types of modern conveniences, and there was hope, you know. But now there's nothing left. It's in Queens. Another fair took its place in 1964 or 65, I believe, in the same area. But, you know, there's something about that fair and those symbols, the trilon, the perisphere, and my parents' recollection of it. And, you know, other things, too, like we talked about arrowheads and stuff like that. I have boards of arrowheads that my father and I collected. Things.
I have my great-grandfather's Bible.
I just wonder who will have those arrowheads when I'm gone and what will happen to them. They're all matted. He wired them each on boards. I mean, he took, like, you know, very thin wire and twisted each back and had holes drilled around each particular arrowhead or piece of pottery and this, that, and the other.
And I'm sure the meticulous man that your father was, he kept up with where he found them and when he found them. And
oh, yeah. I was with him a lot of times on those expeditions. A lot of times I didn't want to go because it was on Saturday afternoon. I wanted to be in the picture show. Nonetheless, I went with him, and that was his therapy, as we talked about before. But nonetheless, you know, collectibles and things that we have, we need to hold on to those things, and we need to not let them go, and we need to be sure that they're left in responsible hands.
Oh, yeah.
And that's...
Well, hence the lectures that I have delivered to, you know, the youngins here. Because, you know, that family, that Bible from a great-grandfather, their great-great-grandfather, the very, you know, I've talked about how at the end of his day, he would come in from the fields.
Play the banjo?
Well, but he would first have a glass of warm sugar water. And I have the glass that he had the sugar water.
I guess he probably needed it after being out in the field. He needed a little pep up, I guess.
And you know, he was a temperate man. But he grew his own apples, and he would sit there and slice an apple and cut it up in pieces for the children.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as many apples as it took. Read him the Bible and then play him the banjo. What I wouldn't give to have that banjo.
Yeah, absolutely.
But there's other of that stuff, you know, banging about, and the whole thing is, you know, listen, this must be tended to, this must be cared for.
God, what I give to have a Russian balalaika from a certain period of time, you know?
Yeah, and you know, in some instances, there were obvious attempts to preserve things against the depredations of time and human activity. Think about the Dead Sea Scrolls or the Nag Hammadi Library. Both of those things were secreted away because there was a concern that it would be lost, and the people felt like it had to be preserved because obviously somebody was out there trying to suppress it. Because
right.
it's only from the Nag Hammadi Library that we have the Gnostic Gospels, which present a very, very different view of the early church.
Now, I have seen dates about those things, and some of them, I don't know if they're contemporaneous with the period in which they were written or whatever, but I think there's some problem with the radiocarbon dating on some of those things. I'm not sure.
No, they've not been disproved.
No, I mean, no, not disproved. I'm talking about the material upon which they were written.
I don't know how much radiocarbon dating was done. But there's been a lot of critical analysis.
Bob's done. It basically can guarantee you some type of guarantee of time between maybe 150 years, something like that. And if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, no radiocarbon dating can yield up a precise date.
Well, it can give you an imprecise date.
Yeah, it gives you a date within a margin of error.
Right, 50 to 100 years, I believe, or 150 years, something like that. But, you know, who knows where these things came from, and who knows exactly what they were about. The reason I called, I just wanted to recommend the book to anybody who'd like to try to read it. And this is on an entirely different subject.
That's okay. We shift gears like that all the time. You know that.
Oh, yeah. And it's called The Russians by Hedrick Smith. And it basically is an examination of life in the Soviet era and how stratified society was during the period of the USSR. And they were talking about the people who had access to special shops and things of that nature called Beryoshka shops, birch tree shops. Now, as a visitor, I had access, but the average Russian did not.
Were those what were euphemistically called dollar stores?
No. As a matter of fact, they only took certificate rubles. And there were two kinds of currency. There was a regular currency that was the Russian people could use, and then there were certificate rubles, which were much more valuable. Like, I mean, I think the ratio could have been 100 to whatever, and you couldn't have a certificate ruble unless you had permission to have such.
A variation on that theme exists in Cuba to this day.
Right, but
tourists there have to exchange whatever currency they're bringing in for the CUC, the Cuban Unified Currency.
Yeah, right.
Whereas the people there cannot have that. Instead, they spend the Cuban peso.
Right, and you know those Cuban pesos aren't worth very much, or they can't even be used to buy anything that, for example, a tourist could buy, or in the case of this particular book, The Russians, in which the upper strata of the Soviet ruling class could buy.
So what was in these stores?
Oh, just all kinds of beautiful things. And also certificate rubles were used to for other purchases. But, I mean, they were basically gift shops that were designed for export. Exactly. And as far as other consumer items are concerned and, you know, the economy, you have special clinics, for example, for the Soviet elite, special grocery stores. And they were always hidden behind, you know, facades where nobody knew what they were, but you could always tell, and God pointed out to me, of the types of cars that were parked in front of them. There were these big Zills and Chaikas and big kind of Russian limousines, and the comment was made, for them, communism has arrived. They can eat tomatoes three times a year. Or all year long. And then, you know, they had special clinics for the Soviet elite. And a lot of these clinics had parquet floors. And the saying was, parquet okay, doctor okay. So they had, you know, special access. And then, of course.
And isn't it odd that seems the direction in which we ourselves are going?
Well, I think, we've always gone that way.
Well, no, I mean, you mentioned the stores, and I think about the people who can afford to go to Save-A-Lot and buy ramen versus the people who can go to Whole Paycheck and buy $22 a pound organic, grain-fed, free-range frozen ground beef.
Well, I mean, you know, but the dollar spent the same. But over there it did not. You had to have special access and special permission to get into these stores. Here, if you have the money, you can go and buy anything you want. That's what I'm
the glories of the free market.
Well, and in that case, you know, they had special places where they could live, dacas and things, dacas or whatever you want to call them, country homes, and they had special apartments for people who were...
And much of that still obtains. I mean, the ostentatious culture of consumption took hold with both feet in the 90s and the first decade of this century in Russia. You know, Moscow became the most expensive place on earth to live.
Well,
and you've got Porsches and Ferraris sitting in traffic.
Well, that's happened after the fall of the Soviet Union.
Exactly.
And you had a number of Russian magnates and billionaires who were able to survive that collapse. And, of course, you had a lot of people who weren't able to. But nonetheless, Hedrick Smith's book, The Russians, is a good read because it goes through every aspect of Russian life, whether it's consumerism or whether it's government access and to power and everything. It came out in the 70s, and to tell you the truth, I've read the book so many times, and it was part of reading for a special course I had. And both covers have fallen off. I'm going to have to get it replaced because it's still a good read, and it still applies today to the new Russian oligarchy.
Yeah.
So you know, I guess what I'm trying to say is that communism and its benefits and fruits under the USSR were not for everyone.
Oh, no, and I think to that extent, there's an argument to be had, and I don't mean argument in the unfriendly way, but a discussion to be had.
I know.
About whether or not the Soviet Union was ever actually communist.
I think it was more of a state fascism type thing.
Yeah.
Exactly what it was.
I mean, I think you'd have a hard time slipping a playing card between in the distance between Adolf Hitler and Joseph Stalin.
Now, I'll tell you another good book you might want to take a look at is called The Court of the Red Tsar. I mean, it was Stalin who defended all of these classifications of which I previously spoke. He was the one who not only defended him, but, you know, supported him. And basically, they had classes of people. And I guess it was a model of technocracy. And those who had contributed to the state and those who were important in political positions who had access to these better stores, better shops, better doctors, and, you know, better summer homes and better apartments and stuff like that. Of course, I can tell you one thing right now. I sure as hell wouldn't want to have lived in one of the places he built on the Moscow River called it was the house on the embankment. Because, I mean, when you lived over there, well, you had a front door, and then the secret police had a back door and an elevator. So you should enjoy your place with all its furniture and stuff like that because it was all state furniture, all marked and all cataloged and everything like that. But you never know when, at 4:30 in the morning, hear that grinding elevator coming to the stairs, and somebody was going to take you downtown.
Yeah, old English common law recognizes month-to-month tenancies. That was a moment-by-moment tenancy.
Right. Okay, well, listen, I'll let you get anybody else who wants to talk to you, I'm sure.
All right, you have a good evening, Jim. Take care.
Good night, sir. Bye-bye.
Bye now. Jim is a font of knowledge, as Ron noted last night, on Russian history, Russian culture. And again, it comes in handy because, and I even hate using the word enemy, but the enemy you don't know is much easier to war with than the one you do. Irish Dave pointing out in regard to some of what Jim was talking about, in terms of American parallels. Gated communities? Yeah, because your money, there are places in this country still where your money ain't no good, no matter how much of it you have. I heard an anecdote the other day about Groucho Marx wanted to join the Santa Barbara Beach Club. Groucho Marx. And, of course, they told him, well, heavens forfend, no, you're Jewish. And he said, well, my daughter's only half Jewish. Can she get in the water up to her waist? It's about 12 minutes before the hour, and again, thanks going out to those who have stepped in to help with the fundraising this evening. That would be Ed and Sal. Thank you very much. We stand at the moment with a shortfall of about $120 thus far. 10 at 12, 2 at 60, 4 at 30, 3 at 40. You know the deal. PayPal button or snail, a traditional mail address works just fine either way. Quite the conversations this evening, and I didn't know the program would go where it has gone, but I hope it's at least been marginally informative or engaging. You know, it's fair to say that I never hot up the mic hoping to entertain anyone. I figure there's enough entertainment out there to last a few millennia, and we are in fact entertaining and amusing ourselves to death. Let's go back to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob. How you doing?
What's happening, Dave?
How are you?
I'm well, I think. It'd be a lot better if this God-forsaken snow would stop, but, you know.
Oh, is it snowing out there?
Oh, yeah, it's snowing in March, and according to Steve Scalise of Louisiana, that means there's no such thing as global warming.
Yeah, well, I heard that you guys are getting a nor'easter. Or something's coming up.
I don't know what this is, but I'm hating on it pretty good.
Oh, that's nasty. Yeah, it's a kind of a transitional here. You know, we got a little sun right now, but it was raining, pouring rain a few minutes ago. Boy, I gotta tell you, you brought up Groucho Marx. You know, I was a Marx Brothers fan so much when I was a little kid. You know, I saw that I Love Lucy with Harpo. Remember that?
Oh, yes.
Remember the one where he does the duck soup scene with Lucy, the mirror scene? And I really got into the Marx Brothers when I was a child. And my grandfather and my dad belonged to this club in L.A. And nowadays I'm kind of ashamed to talk about it because it's kind of it was a country club, Hillcrest Country Club. You heard of Hillcrest?
Oh, yes.
With Hillcrest one. So we were over there I was about 11 years old, and we were over there having brunch one Sunday with my grandfather. And this old, old, old guy comes to the table next to us, and my grandfather, he didn't like this guy. It was Groucho. Yeah, it was Groucho, and he used to insult my grandfather a lot. My grandfather was kind of a thin-skinned type of fellow. And Groucho loved people like that because he just loved insulting them. But
it was easy.
Oh yeah. Groucho did that to everybody though. He was the guy that he is in the movie. He was in real life. He just would insult anybody. And anyway, I was thunderstruck, and I got his autograph, and I was. Did you ever read that book, the Marx Brothers scrapbook?
No. There was one that was written after his death regarding his final years. I did read that one.
Well, this one, the Marx Brothers scrapbook was actually, it had interviews with Groucho. It had interviews with some of their directors that were still alive. It was put out in the early 70s. But Groucho was very straightforward, and he swore a lot, and the guy that wrote the book, I think his name was Richard Anobel or something like that. But he took his words down verbatim, and there was kind of a hubbub about it because Groucho had been, you know, if he thought somebody was an asshole, he just would say, "Ah, that guy was an asshole." he was at the height of his career though when the crash happened in 29.
Groucho got beat up pretty good in the crash.
Yeah, he did. He did. He was talking about his brother, Chico, though, because, you know, Chico was like a compulsive gambler.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
He stopped gambling. And he said, yeah, Chico was smart. He enjoyed all of his money. He didn't lose anything in the crash.
Chico, though, I was watching a documentary the other day. Chico got, and they pronounced it Chico, not Chico. I don't know why.
Chico, yeah. He went after the chicks. He was a chicken chaser.
Because they told the story of how Chico got himself broke, and Harpo and Groucho went to, and he was devastated because they threw him out of Hillcrest.
Yeah. They were gonna.
And Harpo and Groucho got together and picked up his membership so that he could go back to Hillcrest and play gin and bridge and whatever. But and this is a life. This is just not off color, but they related a story. You were talking about Chico being a womanizer. They related a story about him meeting Tallulah Bankhead, who was of course a famous beauty.
Uh-huh.
And they said, "Listen, Chico, don't come on to her with all that crude stuff you do, you know, with all the other women." Because apparently Chico was just kind of direct.
Oh, very. Super direct.
And so they related the story of this meeting in which Tallulah Bankhead and Chico meet for the first time. And they exchange pleasantries, talk. And I guess Chico was finally overcome. And he just leans over to her and says, "I just really want to F you." And Tallulah Bankhead looks back at him and says, "And you shall, my dear old-fashioned boy." Oh.
Yeah. He was into that. He was very, the women loved him because he was very straightforward with them, and he would sometimes disappear also. They wouldn't be able to find him because he'd be going and gambling and shooting pool. And
well, sometimes you need to, but when you're sometimes when you're living that life, you need to be able to disappear, Dave. No, I'm a Marx Brothers fan from way back.
I saw most of their movies when I was a kid.
The Sanity Clause scene where he and Chico are tearing up the contract. Well, if it's good enough for you, I don't want it anyway. They and W.C. Fields are my favorite comics of that era.
Well, Groucho relates stories about hanging out with W.C. Fields and Jimmy Durante, and actually, I think when they were writing that book, I was talking about the Marx Brothers scrapbook. Jimmy Durante was dying right at that time, and he said in Groucho, in one of the interviews, he was saying, "God, I was at the hospital today, and I was, I saw Jimmy Durante, and he was, you know, delusional, and he didn't even recognize me." And he lived till he was about 86 or 87.
Yeah, and Groucho didn't care much for the getting liquored up and carousing and carrying on.
No, he was one of those type of people that.
Whereas, of course, Fields was the exact opposite.
Exactly. Yeah. Groucho was very.
I remember the time we were in Afghanistan. We'd lost our corkscrew. We were forced to live for 2 weeks on nothing but food and water.
Yeah.
Or the scene where they pulled it during Prohibition, where they pulled the liquor bottle. Was it during Prohibition? Anyway, they pulled the liquor bottle out of his golf bag, and he says, "I keep that in case I see a snake." And he jumps and says, "Give me the Canadian club." Hey, we've managed to wipe out the remaining minutes of the program, Dave. Thanks so much for calling in.
We'll talk soon.
All right, take care. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Wow, a little brush with history. Dave calling from Portland. It is time to get out of here. Thanks very much to Henry. who just took us down to only $100 to go for this evening's fundraising, and that is sincerely appreciated. And hopefully we will make up the shortfall before program time tomorrow. I'm sorry for the other calls I did not get to, but you know what? We'll have prayer meeting Wednesday tomorrow, and we'll get right after it. Thanks to everybody who makes all of this happen. You, first of all, for sharing your time with the Horn Family Commune. And thanks for your kind contributions that keep all of this going. Thank you to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky and Texas Betsy in the chat room, our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thank you to John Fox. Thank you to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ACHECT, ACHECT.org. After the day we had today, you know what? You can be proud of everything you've ever done to help advance the ACHECT, and I hope a little bit inspired to go and do even more, because the ACHECT is the only way we will ever stop mountaintop removal in Appalachia, at least before the coal companies just blow everything straight to hell. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Rick Smith is next on the Horn.